Today on This Week in Law, we have an excellent panel to discuss the Intimate Privacy Protection Act of 2016, the DMCA and the EFF issues with it, as well as the very first Pokemon Go lawsuit and how to teach your dog how to take selfies. So stay tuned to This Week in Law coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law, with Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and Denise Howe, recorded August 5th, 2016, episode 355, Tinkerers Kobayashi Maru.
This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/twill and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/twill.
Hey folks, Emery Roan here, and you're tuned into This Week in Law. Your eyes and ears do not deceive you. Denise is unfortunately out of town this week, but the co-hosts have taken over, and I think we've got an excellent show for you. An awesome panel of guests, longtime friend of the show, Colette Vogel. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Colette is a longtime IP practitioner, a former fellow at the Stanford Center for the Internet and Society, and co-founder and president of Without My Consent, an awesome organization that we're going to give some time to in just a little bit. Also joining us today is Franklin Graves. Franklin is what you could consider the Genesis intern here at This Week in Law. He was the first intern 4 years ago and is also responsible for a number of the bumpers that we love to run in between our spots.
That is currently very true. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming here. Franklin, I think you're living and practicing in Nashville, Tennessee, and you're general counsel for Naxos Music Group, right?
That is correct.
All right. And if I'm not mistaken, you're also the author of an children's ebook, Lily's Grand Adventure.
I wrote an ebook that is illustrated with a bunch of public domain works or Creative Commons license stuff. And it was more of for my wife. And it's all about pugs. So it is on Amazon. It's not free, unfortunately, but maybe I should do a promotion to make it free. Why not?
I think it might be on Kindle Unlimited. You'll have to check. And of course, joining us is also Michael Keyes, back from a short break to do very busy work. Michael is an IP attorney with Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle, co-editor of the IP blog, thetmca.com. As always, thanks for being here, Mike.
Absolutely. Great to be with you and great to be with our great panelists today. I'm really excited about today's show and great to be back.
Yeah, welcome. All right. Well, I think with that, we're going to get started. And because, as I said, Franklin has made or was responsible for so many of these bumpers, I'm really going to try to run as many of them as possible. So let's get started and we'll move into legislation, regulation, and policy. All right. So, Colette, could you give us, a little bit of background about Without My Consent? And we're going to try to talk about the IPPA, which is some proposed legislation. I think, well, why don't you take it away?
Sure. Thanks. So as some viewers might know, Without My Consent is the organization I co-founded. We just had our fifth anniversary this summer. We grew out of practice that I had where I was representing early victims of revenge porn. And I felt very frustrated that it seemed like a pretty obvious privacy problem and violation of some pretty basic privacy principles. But it was a very much a practical struggle because even though the law was available, it was a very blunt instrument and not a very good way in some cases to solve the actual problem, which was intimate images being displayed online and in various contexts without the individual depicted's consent. Often used in today, over these 5 years, we've learned a lot about the problem. A lot of other people are involved and have been since the beginning in challenging these issues. Some of our board members are leaders in this space, including Danielle Citron, who is our advisory board member and has been since the start, and has written the book on hate crimes in cyberspace. In the 5 years, we've seen quite a journey from industry interest and, you know, the tech industry trying to find ways to deal with this problem. And that has been really great in the last basically 18 months to 2 years. We've seen a real increase in tools being made available. And we've also seen a lot of media attention over these years. And some of the kind of big points were when the iPhone hacking or iCloud storage hacking happened and celebrities were directly impacted. It brought a lot of actually needed attention to the problem. So what's been really interesting in the last year, and especially in the last month, was that the federal legislation has now been introduced that would create a federal penalty, civil and criminal options to pursue somebody who is engaging in distribution of intimate images without the person's consent. It's a little more nuanced than that, but that's generally what the IPPA would do, and it's called the Intimate Privacy Protection Act. That act came about from great work from Jackie Spear's office, Congresswoman from California. Many other people had been involved. I know Marianne Franks from the University of Miami has been a spearhead in working on, you know, solid legislative proposals that would pass constitutional muster. She's been a pioneer in trying to explain how you can craft a legislation of this sort that can pass and also survive constitutional scrutiny. And so she's been phenomenal in moving this ball forward. And then an organization on which she is a board member is the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, which was originally founded or the precursor to it was originally founded by victims of revenge porn. So it's been really a grassroots effort, and they've done some phenomenal work in the legislative side. So that's sort of the latest. It's a quick review of where we've come in 5 years. Let me just plug one thing that Without My Consent is doing right now. Last year we received a really substantial grant from the Digital Trust Foundation, and we've been releasing materials that we've prepared as a result of that grant. One of the things that we released several months ago is something called the Something Can Be Done Guide. You can find it on our website, and it is certainly, I think it's the best basic information for victims and attorneys and advocates to go to figure out, well, what can I do? This happened to me. What steps can I take? And, oh, great, it's up on the screen now. This is the first installment. The second installment is coming very soon. I think it will get it published in September, and it will address some other aspects of this problem. But this is sort of how to preserve your evidence, how to present your case, how to identify the facts for somebody who's going to then need to use those facts to advocate for you. It has forms and samples, talks about how to register a copyright in an intimate image and things like that. So it's, I think, very, very practical advice that anybody who needs to drill deeper into this can start there and learn quite a bit. That's one piece of our Digital Trust Foundation grant work. And then the 50 State Project is another tab on that screen. It was the first thing we started doing when we founded Without My Consent. And you'll see there's a number of states identified in the left-hand column plus federal. Those are the states where we have completed a review of all of the laws that we think touch on this issue of the distribution of images without one's consent. It's very comprehensive, and it's been done at the with great help from the University of Berkeley, Berkeley School of Law, one of their clinics, and then a bunch of different law firms that have been helping us put together this stuff. We have most recently published Vermont, Texas, and Washington, which you'll see, and forthcoming are Ohio, Oregon, Tennessee, and Wisconsin. So we're slowly building it out. This is one of these projects that takes many years when you're using volunteer time, but we want it to be the most up-to-date and best information. And so to do that, it does take time.
All right. So I want to talk a little bit about the I want to talk a little bit about the Intimate Privacy Protection Act then in that context. We have obviously you're working on a state-by-state analysis of the state statutes, and obviously the IPPA would create a federal cause of action. Would the IPPA, I guess, supersede all of the state statutes, or is this something entirely different?
So I think there are 34 states that have now passed specific laws related to revenge porn. Don't have the list at the on the tip of my tongue, but the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative's website has a page where they, I think, list out the states that have specific revenge porn laws. The IPPA is just a pure federal action that someone could bring. And I do not believe it preempts the state actions. So that should answer that question. All the other states that we've looked at, I mean, like I remember when I first looked at California when I was practicing there and trying to help victims. I mean, there is actually a lot of laws that sort of fit, that work, that if you need to bring something civilly, you have an option. The problem is really in the criminal space. The prosecutors are burdened, investigations don't go well, and it's hard to prioritize one of these cases when you're not sure that the court's going to fit it into the law that you think might apply, you know. And the nice thing about having clear laws that address the particular issue is people who might be perpetrators of it or have clear notice, like this is what we're saying you can't be doing. But also when it comes to bringing a case, prosecutors are more inclined to see, oh yeah, these facts fit this exact scenario, so this makes sense and we can bring it.
So obviously there's some Section 230 CDA implications here. I was reading that there was sort of an exemption carved out for ISPs, if I'm not mistaken. Is there any other sort of issues on that front? Because I would imagine that would be a real sticking point, especially going to your point earlier about, you know, this is something substantive to do to solve the problem of distribution of the revenge porn. So how do you think that the IPPA sort of addresses that?
Yeah, so my understanding, now I wasn't involved in all the efforts that went into getting this together, but my understanding is, and I know from just seeing how long it took, the proponents, including, of course, Jackie Spear's office, spent a significant amount of time working with industry players, you know, ISPs and companies whose tools and services might be used to perpetrate these crimes. And they had opportunities to give feedback and input into how the legislation may be crafted. So I think that there was a really important dialogue that happened before the thing was proposed, so that most of those issues have been sort of hammered out. I can't predict. You never know what different companies might see as a threat to their business. But there is a carve out for ISPs in the legislation. I have it pulled up here. I can find the section, but it very closely tracks the Communications Act and the CDA, the Telecommunications Act and the CDA. So the language should make it pretty clear what's being carved out or not. You're not exempted, just like under the CDA, if you've done something yourself. You know, if the company has itself promoted or made a special effort to, you know, I forget the language from the CDA, something in part, it's a develop in part the content, then you're not going to be exempted. But if you're really just the platform, you're neutral, you're allowing all sorts of different things on your platform and you're not promoting one or the other, then you're not going to be, you know, swallowed up by this, the IPPA.
And I guess just on, legislative predictions, is there much pushback from this? It sounds like this would be a, you know, plain and obvious bipartisan supported bill. Is there anything that we need to watch out for? Is this basically a done deal, do you think?
Oh, I would never say that. I think I certainly don't. I'm not so closely tied to what's actually happening behind the scenes at all. So, but I would never say a piece of legislation is a done deal.
That's probably a safe.
Will actually be proposed to be actually voted on. But I'm optimistic. You know, there's always people who, when they see a statute, this has been the case with the state statutes. Anytime one has been passed, and some organizations will attack it for violating the First Amendment and free expression rights. And frankly, some of the state statutes really weren't crafted thoughtfully in that regard, and have been found unconstitutional or rejiggered after the fact. I'm thinking of Arizona in particular, but there may be others. And so it's been really key to have somebody like Marianne Franks, who understands that law, but is also a very strong victims proponent, supporter, to really think through how can you craft this in a way that avoids the First Amendment problems. Now, Erwin Chemerinsky, famous First Amendment or constitutional attorney and law professor, has said that this legislation is totally fine. I've seen Eugene Volokh, also fairly conservative and very wise when it comes to the First Amendment issues. He also believes you can craft a law that to protect revenge porn or protect against revenge porn, as long as it's narrowly tailored. And I think this law goes there. It's very specific about what's being excluded from, what activities and what content would be the cause of to bring a cause for this kind of a privacy violation. And what's interesting to me also on that point is this law is about privacy, and a lot of other ways to deal legally with revenge porn is kind of using copyright in a kind of contorted way to protect your privacy and using other laws that might not be on really about privacy to try and protect this mm-hmm. from this, like the reputation type laws. And we have federal laws covering social security numbers and other things that we consider to be protected under privacy. But it's striking to me that this would create such any great pushback, when we're willing to protect, things like social security numbers to the same degree. So in terms of pushback, I'm sure there will be some. I'm sure some people will try to find problems with it under the First Amendment. And it's I think, a red herring, but it is going to happen. And, I think the proponents are very prepared to have that discussion. And, it should go through the normal legislative process and be really vetted that way.
Well, it sounds like, at least to me, it sounds like plain English. And I certainly wish it the best. If there are any advocacy websites that you know of, or advocacy organizations that are sort of following the political process of this, that you can recommend for our listeners to check out?
I would definitely check out the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative's website. They will have the latest on it, I'm sure, and also follow the Twitter feeds for them. And Without My Consent will also be, we'll follow it. We have a weekly newsletter. I should let people know, if they don't know already, that you can sign up for. It's an email blast, and we send it roughly once a week. Sometimes if we skip a week here and there, because it's put together also through volunteers. And we try to highlight all the latest things that have happened in the past week that we think are relevant to the audience. It's very short. So if people subscribe to that, they will hear about updates, within a week or so of things happening. But, Twitter is a little more live in real time. And the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, they've just done some fantastic work in this space and are very close to that aspect of, getting states and feds to pass some legislation.
All right. Well, that's awesome. Mike Franklin, do you have anything to add to this issue?
Yeah, Colette, our hats are off to you and Without My Consent. You all are doing some phenomenal things in a much needed space. A question about You talked quite a bit about advocacy and legislative initiatives that you're involved with or without my consent's involved with. What about in terms of legal protection? Do you have – does Without My Consent like have a referral to various law firms and other practitioners that have agreed to take on cases pro bono? And how does that work?
Yeah, well, I can make a recommendation now. It's been a dream of mine from when we originally founded Without My Consent to create some kind of referral network. It's very – we just haven't had the bandwidth to do it. And it requires some thought because you need – you know, you want to kind of vet a little bit who's on that list and have some you know, structure around it that we just haven't had the chance to do in a good way. And so I don't want to do it unless we can really do it right. So that is maybe something we can launch in the future. However, for the law firm K&L Gates has a fantastic program that they launched called the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project. They have a website and they have an intake form there. And victims who are running into revenge porn type problems can submit through their web form a request to have their case reviewed. And they have a team of lawyers. I want to say they had maybe 50 cases so far, 50. I mean, that's a lot. They launched, I think, about a year and a half ago. And they're the two leads of that program. Are fantastic attorneys. One of them is in Seattle, David Bateman, and the other one is Elisa D'Amico in Florida. And they've, I think, you know, really shown how this can be done. And the hardest thing with these cases is potentially the securing the evidence and then the forensic part of figuring out who did what and having the evidence that proves it. So they've really mastered that and offers pro bono to victims legal support in many cases filing cases.
Yeah, that's terrific. I personally know Dave. He's a former partner of mine. Great guy, great lawyer, and I know they're doing a lot of terrific pro bono work over there at K&L Gates. So we applaud them for their efforts as well.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. All right. Franklin, anything to add before we move on to Mike's cribbing article from last week?
No, it all sounds pretty incredible work that's being done. So I applaud that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. A huge thanks to Without My Consent and Colette and all their hard work.
Thank you.
And we're just going to move on to Mike. You didn't get to be here last week. You were super busy, but you had a great article on Melania Trump's potentially plagiarized, potentially copyright infringing RNC speech. You want to take it away?
Sure. So this is an article that the National Law Journal saw a blog post that I wrote on the Melania Trump speech where she cribbed from or allegedly cribbed from Michelle Obama's speech from 2008. We put together a short little blog post here at the TMCA regarding, you know, what's the difference between plagiarism and copyright infringement, how are they related, and whether this potentially cribbing from Michelle Obama's speech constituted an act of copyright infringement. So we posted a short little post on that, and then I was contacted by the National Law Journal to provide a little bit bigger op-ed piece that was just recently published. So really, the scope of the article, there was so much uproar about this. It's somewhat died down, although it hasn't completely gone away, I suppose. But of course, Melania gave a pretty good speech in support of the Donald's candidacy. And soon after the speech, if not during, one of the attendees at the Republican National Convention had tweeted that, look, this has some striking similarities to some of the things that Michelle Obama said. And of course, Michelle Obama, she was not, this was not attributed to her. And so everybody was screaming plagiarism. And then we talked about also the copyright aspects of this. Would this constitute copyright infringement? And I think you could make a case that it probably would. There's probably enough copying there for it to constitute infringement. Probably be hard to say that there's a fair use associated with this type of copying. Probably a closer call as to whether it's de minimis. It wasn't a huge amount of copying, but you know, there's been several sentences, maybe enough of a paragraph to make out a prima facie case of copyright infringement. So,
on the de minimis question, obviously we have some onerous rulings regarding de minimis takings for sound recordings. Is there much case law on what a de minimis taking for speeches, or I guess for this type of content?
Yeah. So, where you typically see the de minimis copying, I know I can think of a couple of cases where somebody's photograph or a painting appeared in the background of a movie, and it was a fleeting reference to it, and it was out of focus. Courts in those instances have said, look, that's probably de minimis. It's just not – the law does not concern itself with trifles. That's just too small. Nobody would actually be able to detect that there was any sort of copying going on there unless you're really you set out to detect any sort of reproduction whatsoever, however brief. So in those types of instances, courts have said that's just not sufficient. It's too de minimis. Here I think it's probably – it's probably not as strong of an argument for Mrs. Trump. So I should also say that to be fair, of course, Melania Trump is not the first politician or pseudo politician, I suppose, to have been accused of plagiarism. there's the list is long and distinguished of politicians that have cribbed from other politicians and other authors. So one of the comments on the Law Journal from a reader was, you know, don't you have anything better to do? If you do, you should talk about, you know, Joe Biden and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and so on and so forth. So,
you know, I saw that. I think that would be an interesting article if you have the time. Frankly, I'd love to read it.
Yeah, I told that rather disgruntled reader that, look, I don't know if I have time between all of my tennis matches and swimming and sailing the San Juan Islands. But if I do, I'll make sure to attribute that idea to that particular reader. So,
well, internet jerks aside, Franklin and Colette, do you have anything to add to this?
I guess I like, as a copyright person, I've always have found the difference of de minimis depending on if you're talking about text or music or maybe other forms of creative expression to be. So, it's so interesting to me that you can have a few beats of a song be an allegation of infringement, but yeah, in text, it's just not the same. The courts don't. You have to take much more, I think. And that's an interesting – I wonder if there's been any studies that compare the various different forms of expression and how that works. It's just an observation. I don't really have a conclusion on it. I do know just from working a lot in the software industry and looking at code and different things like that, there is – when you have a work that's highly, highly functional and less creative, I think the de minimis exception or defense, you can get a little further along with that.
That brings up a good point, I guess. Someone actually in the chat brought up that, you know, this might their take on this was that if this was a European issue, that the whole discussion would be framed a little differently. And we've got a whole host of IP experts on our panel. So what do you guys think about that? If this was, following the European conception of copyright law?
Oh, yeah.
Are you speaking specifically like with respect to moral rights?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for our listeners, the European copyright system values the idea of copyrights are sort of springing forth from the author much more than the American system, which is much more a sort of economic incentives model. So the chat was saying that if this was a European issue, then probably, you know, the de minimis taking, for example, wouldn't have been as much of a defense, and the, you know, case for infringing would probably be stronger. Does that sound like it rings true to everyone else?
Yeah, I spent a little over a year in Brussels in 2013, 2014, and I got a real good, I feel like I had a really good understanding from that experience in how different the frame around IP and actually, frankly, a lot of rights, including privacy, which has obviously been the news all the time, how there's a much more of a personal tie. And you can't just do something with someone else's stuff, whether it's their private information in a privacy context or their authorship, things they've authored in the copyright context, without really, it's a piece of the person in a way. And I know that there's been, you know, social, you know, law reviews and other articles and studies about this fundamental cultural difference. And it's very important. I do think that it would have, it wouldn't have been framed in the context of, is this a fair use or is this a de minimis or, an, you know, it would be much more of a tie to the person that Melania took the content from. So Michelle, but yeah, it's a really interesting distinction between the U.S. and European views and cultural norms.
I can't speak directly to the European law, but I think P.S. Chops points out in IRC a really good point. And this person mentions if the speech was written by someone that was employed by the federal government, then wouldn't this be a place where it's immediately put in the public domain? And I think that's true. But at the same time, if I'm understanding correctly, Michelle Obama's speech was prior to her becoming the first lady. So I don't know if it would apply in that sense because the funding for the campaign is all private. And I don't know if, what the relationship is there and whether that would still be considered a government employee or the speechwriter, I guess.
Yeah, I don't
no,
think
it's a good point, but oh, go ahead, Colette.
No, you got it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure, although she's certainly married to a government employee, I'm not sure that she's compensated or otherwise. I don't know. Maybe being first lady is an actual employment position within the federal government. I suppose if it was, as you pointed out, Franklin, you know, she gave the speech when it was still candidate Obama that was running for the White House as opposed to President Obama. So I don't think that would apply.
I think it's an awesome question for a law school exam, to be honest. An incumbent presidential wife was making this speech.
Right.
And what? All right. So I think that wraps up that issue. We're going to move, keep talking about copyright. So let's play another bumper. Copyright. All right. So from some maybe infringement to some pretty blatant infringement, there was a sort of bombshell articles case that came up this week and end of last week involving Getty Images. Does anyone want to cover that? Or I'm happy to. I guess I'll do it.
Take it away, Emery.
So, all right. So you may, you know, every week at This Week in Law, we, you know, almost every week it feels like we highlight some ridiculous DMCA complaint. I think this one might take the cake. So Getty Images, pretty renowned as being a little trollish with the way they handle their copyright, filed the DMCA fail of a takedown to end all takedowns when they sent one to U.S. photographer Carol Highsmith. Carol Highsmith has very graciously over the years been giving her photographs to the Library of Congress with a very simple it's been mischaracterized, I think, in the press as public domain, but basically a very simple attribution license saying that anyone can use these photographs if they just give attribution to her. Well, Getty has apparently been using these photographs, plastering their watermark on it, and then charging people licenses. And they sent a takedown request to Carol Highsmith for her own photograph. So just let that sink in. If we can just pause and appreciate that situation. But Carol has fired back with, of course, a lawsuit against Getty that is alleging the maximum amount of penalties. And in addition to the fact, because Getty was in the past 3 years found guilty of infringement, the amount of damages are trebled. So she's looking at a $1 billion lawsuit against Getty for the total of 18,755 photographs that were taken from her. And plastered with their false watermarks. So I don't have as much to add. I think this is absolutely hilarious and definitely a case to follow. and sort of illustrative of the dangers, I guess, that of the DMCA takedown process. But I definitely wanted to put it up to our guests. You know, we have a whole panel full of IP attorneys. What is your take from this, Mike?
Well, okay, so it's interesting. When I first read about it, I thought, okay, that's an interesting claim. When I read the complaint, I was intrigued. Here's what's not clear to me, though. As I understand the claim, she's claiming not that there's infringement, but I could be wrong on that. But I think what she's claiming is that this is a Section 1202 violation where there has been a removal of her copyright management information. And that's the basis upon which she moved for statutory damages, asking for them to be trebled. And that's how you get to ultimately this $1 billion figure. So I think that there's a couple of co-defendants, too, as I understand it from reading the complaint, that have also allegedly removed or altered her copyright management information. Now, let's assume that that happened, that the copyright management information was removed. Under 1202, I believe it's only actionable to remove copyright management information if you're doing so for the purposes of concealing infringement, concealing or otherwise facilitating infringement. Now, if she's already provided essentially a public license for folks to reproduce the photograph and otherwise engage in the exclusive rights under Section 106, I'm not sure that removal of copyright management information in this context is actionable. Again, this is just my musings after reviewing the complaint, because you're not concealing or otherwise facilitating infringement, because these works have already been there's already this public license to exercise Section 106 rights with respect to those works. So I don't know. I think the complaint's really well written. It's interesting, but I'm just not sure ultimately that it's going to be successful based on my understanding of the facts at this point.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. I know that there is some issue about whether or not this work is in the public domain, or whether this was licensed under a sort of simple precursor to the CC licenses that we're familiar with. But yeah, I was actually having the same issue as you were. This is, you know, if she did donate this to the public domain, does she have any control over how another person uses works that are in the public domain? Is that copyright infringement? I definitely need to dig down a little deeper. What about Colette? Franklin, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I actually was looking and I pulled on Pacer the Exhibit B, which shows, and I put a link to this PDF in the IRC channel. But basically the wording of the, they call it an instrument of gift, is how she conveyed some of these pictures and photographs to the library. So it's very interesting language in that, like, for instance, it says in kind of the preamble, it says, "I hereby dedicate to the public all rights, including copyrights throughout the world, that I possess in this collection." But then later on, they talk about there's some limiting provisions that are talking about how it can be reproduced. And overall, I'm curious, and it will be interesting to see how heavily they argue the fact that these may or may not be in the public domain, because that really could change everything. Like some people already said.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, if I can jump in, is that a license, or is that it's hard to put things in the public domain before the statute says they get there, before their 50 or 70 years, life of the author plus 70 years, or whatever the term is for the particular work in the U.S. And I know this from watching how Creative Commons has tried to create public domain dedications.
Yep.
I've not dug super deep on this, so I bet if we had somebody from Creative Commons from a few years ago when they were, you know, first coming up with their public domain dedication tools, we'd have a really deep and interesting nerdy copyright discussion about it, because it's not as easy as it might seem. And, you know, an express license, like a Creative Commons license, or what sounds like this author put in her grant, however you want to call it, that will be pulled apart in this litigation. That will be very, very important to understanding what rights Getty may or may not have had. And if that license or dedication is contingent on certain things, like keeping her credit associated with the photo. Maybe that's what they did wrong, and it's more of a breach of a license case. I'm actually surprised. Well, they probably didn't want to do an either or complaint, but maybe they could have included a breach of license claim.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how difficult it is to put things in the public domain. Sorry, Frank, do you want to take that?
Oh, no problem. So, Colette, you bring up a really interesting issue about the intersection of contract law with copyright. Because sometimes if you breach a contract, breach a license agreement, that can constitute an act of copyright infringement, but sometimes it doesn't. So I think that's going to be really important for – as Colette mentioned, I mean, no doubt that that grant from the photographer is going to be pulled apart here. And I think they're going to try to dissect, is a breach of this particular grant, would that just be limited to a breach claim, or would this be an act of infringement? Because if you can make out that it's an act of infringement as a result of the breach, then maybe you've got a Section 1202 claim. But even then, I think you have to show that it was intentionally done to conceal it. It's an interesting claim. It's going to be very fascinating to follow and see what happens.
Yeah. And I always wonder when I see these things actually end up in a lawsuit filed, what happened like immediately before? What was the conversation between the photographer's lawyers and Getty? Was Getty like, here, talk to the hand, we don't think this is an issue, and they were like, fine, we're going to sue? Or did they maybe have some pre-discussions and they just couldn't come to an agreement, so this was the next step? No, we don't really have visibility into that history.
And right. Also, one thing is, so who is responsible for making sure that the usage of the works from the, like, if I get it from the Library of Congress, who's responsible for making sure that, like, Getty Images is using this appropriately? Because the suit is from the copyright owner, the original owner, the creator of the work. But because she granted a license to the Library of Congress, does that mean that they are the ones that need to control and administer how the licenses are used by people that visit their website?
Definitely going to be one to follow. Yeah.
Good question.
Well, Colette, I will take your note to heart and try very hard to get someone from CC here to give us an in-the-weed, super nerdy discussion of their CC Zero mark, which I think is retired. But
Is it retired? Okay,
I think their CC Zero mark is retired. I know that one of their public domain marks they retired. But I'll have to do some research on that. And listeners, you'll hear whenever we have a CC expert on the show. All right. So moving on from that, Franklin, you brought up a really interesting article or potential bill to my attention regarding small claims court legislation for copyright issues. Do you want to give us a little bit of background on that?
Yeah, definitely. So in 2013, I believe it was. Let me pull up my notes. Yeah, in 2013, there was a report from the Copyright Office regarding the creation of a small claims court. So if you've ever been involved or had to try and protect your works as a copyright owner or creator, then you realize that, first of all, the bar to go after infringement is basically getting into federal court, and that can be very expensive. So if it's something that is not really valuable or there's not much money to be had by the end of it, and especially if you haven't registered the works, in that case, you're really kind of out of luck and you're having to come up with the decision-making power of whether you want to spend money and possibly be out thousands and tens of thousands of dollars or more by pursuing litigation. So there's been this need and a recognition for the need of a small claims court from the Copyright Office. So there is a new bill or there's new legislation that's been introduced called the CASE Act. And there it is on the screen. So it's pretty interesting to see how this will go about getting created and what the overall implementation of it will be. But I think, in my opinion, it will be a very good option for copyright owners to be able to hopefully have an alternative to federal court for protecting their copyrights.
Could you go, I guess, a little more into the weeds about structurally what this would look like for the average creator that has a small copyright claim? What would they why would this be a preferable option than to be filing the traditional claim in court or in federal court? Sorry.
Well, I mean, I guess money is the main reason. I mean, that's one of the sticking points is just financially it's extremely difficult to fund litigation. Not only like it's attorney's fees, but court filing fees, all of it. And there's a like if you just go and look at any docket, like the ones we were just looking at related to copyright filings there or copyright litigation, the dockets get drastically numerous in the number of filings that there are. So I think that's one of the main reasons behind this, one of the policy reasons behind creating this.
I'll be honest, I think this is just showing my ignorance of small claims courts in general. So I'm going to leave this to our panel to maybe explain a little better. Mike, you were saying?
I love this bill, personally. I think it's a great idea. All too often, you've got really legitimate claims of copyright infringement that it's just not practical necessarily to enforce it in federal court. You know, obviously the federal court system is great and, you know, the judges by and large are very familiar with copyright and experienced in this particular area of law, of course. But it can be very, very expensive, especially if you don't have the likelihood of statutory damages or attorney's fees. And so you're left with, you know, really not a viable method for seeking redress. And this, of course, is for very small claims of copyright infringement. I think the most that the Copyright Board could award is up to $30,000 in a single proceeding. So if it's a relatively minor infringement in terms of dollar value, it seems like it's a great place to go. It seems like the process is going to be a bit more expedited. I believe there is discovery under this proposed bill, but no doubt it's not going to be as formalized as in federal court. And this is all voluntary, by the way. We should make it clear that you're not forced to, at least as I read this bill, even if a plaintiff initiates an action before this copyright board, I don't believe it's mandatory. I believe that the defendant can still go to federal court to have the case litigated there. But maybe I'm wrong on that. It looked like it was voluntary by the parties. So
no, I agree. That's what I was understanding after reading it as well. It's a voluntary option. So.
Right.
I guess so, my only experience with the Copyright Office is their sort of triennial rulemaking process. But when I think of the Copyright Office and efficiency, I don't really think that those two words are usually close together in the sentence. Do you think that the copyright, so I'm imagining, for example, you know, small copyright claims are basically the bread and butter of YouTube takedown requests. And if we're seeing, you know, millions of those per month, which I think is what we're seeing, do you think that the Copyright Office would be effectively more or better equipped to handle that backlog than maybe some more, I don't know, a different approach? Is this really going to be effective, do you think?
Well, the legislation itself provides for staffing. I think it sets up a copyright board, and I think there was some reference to that a couple of staff attorneys that will be responsible for administering claims and so on and so forth. So I think it's going to be handled by a separate, you know, a subset of folks at the Copyright Office, I think. Franklin?
I'm not positive about that. The exact, it's still early on. I haven't read through the entire thing yet, but I wanted to go back to what you mentioned, Emery, about the situation like we're seeing with like YouTube's content ID system. I think the difference here and why you really shouldn't compare it, at least in my opinion, is because you're looking at an automated system that YouTube does where it's just generating all these claims against content. So what this would be more of is the active decision to go this route by individual copyright owner. So it's not just going to automatically be as soon as there's an infringement, some algorithm's going to detect it and then automatically send it into the copyright, into this process. But I mean, at least now, I mean, I say that, and then a couple episodes ago you had all the people that were doing the bots. So I mean, I say that now and it could easily be changed, but I would hope that it doesn't go that route, at least now for the sake of not having it automated. But I think that's kind of a distinction that I would draw between the two.
Let me just ask a question. I'm not that familiar with the details of the proposed board, but does it enable people to be represented by attorneys, or does it prohibit that? Because I know in what we normally call small claims court, attorneys are not permitted. People have to represent themselves. Did it say anything about that?
I believe it did. I believe it said you can either go it alone or you can have counsel represent you. I believe I saw that in the bill.
Okay. Okay. It's interesting. Yeah.
Well, I will defer to Mike's optimism on this issue then. And keep my fingers crossed that this is going to do some good in the world.
I may ultimately be wrong, Emery. Maybe it's going to be a complete disaster, but I don't know how this legislation was ever proposed. I mean, I know it's been kicking around for a while. It's interesting because you wouldn't think that this would catch the attention of Congress, you know, particularly given what's at issue. It's really small acts of infringement, at least in terms of small dollars. So I don't know what the history of it is, but I think it's an interesting proposal, and I'll be excited to watch it and see if it actually passes.
Definitely. So I think we have just one last copyright issue before, unfortunately, Colette, you have to leave. So studio, we're going to run one last issue of copyright and then probably an ad and move on from there. But I wanted to bring up the fact that last week, the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Copyright Office and the DOJ, alleging that Section 1201 of the DMCA is unconstitutional. So I think it's a really interesting issue, which I'm happy to dive into if no one else wants to take it away. All right.
Go right ahead.
So the long and the short of, you have to have a little bit of background on this, listeners. So we're talking about the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Section 1201 of the DMCA is a measure that prevents the circumvention of what are called technological protective measures on copyrighted works. So we're talking about jailbreaking your iPod. We're talking about burning a CD of an album that you bought on iTunes so that you could then rip it back to your computer. But we're also talking about things like doing security research. So the EFF has a little bit of the process. I mentioned the triennial rulemaking process earlier. Essentially, there are exemptions to the 1201 prohibition on circumvention of technological measures. It's a mouthful, but the Copyright Office meets every 3 years to go through a rulemaking process where they take comments from the public and from the various industries that are interested and re-decide each 3 years the state of these exemptions to Section 1201 of the DMCA. Actually, that was one of the first things I did at New Media Rights last year was went up to Los Angeles to sit in on the triennial rulemaking process when we were arguing that Section 1201 needed an exemption for documentary filmmakers, but also for other filmmakers that are wanting to make a fair use. And so the long and the short of that is that the Copyright Office declined to expand those exemptions. The EFF has filed this lawsuit essentially in response to that rulemaking process, saying that Section 1201 is on its face facially unconstitutional because it is prohibiting speech that would be permitted. These technological measures may, for example, prevent you from doing what would be considered a fair use type of research on voting machines or your cars. Now, the EFF filed this lawsuit saying that I think we can pull it up. I can't see the screen right now what is being displayed, but there are a number of arguments that they're making, essentially that Section 1201 prohibits protected speech, that Section 1201A statutorily requires that the Copyright Office not place or create exemptions where it would prohibit or where it would chill protected speech. And they make the argument that I think very convincingly that these type of technological measures are chilling otherwise protected speech. So I think it's a very interesting issue to follow. I'm definitely going to be following it close, but we have a panel full of IP attorneys that I'm sure have at least some opinion on Section 1201 of the DMCA. So anyone else care to comment?
Yeah, I think the First Amendment approach is a very interesting one, for sure, because the fact that using copyright law in this manner, and especially with the exceptions, does basically take control over a lot of the uses that might be applicable in this case. For instance, I wrote an article about the Internet of Things and how how the DMCA and this provision are being used to make it to where people can't tinker with their own devices in their homes. And so the vehicles is definitely one of them. And so, as you mentioned, every 3 years, the Copyright Office goes and reviews what the exemptions are. And so it was particularly interesting that the fact that vehicle manufacturers can have so much control over how users tinker with their cars. And even we saw it with Keurig, where Green Mountain Coffee was trying to come up with a way to use the DMCA and this provision to prevent workarounds for their, they did like the Keurig 2.0, where you could, you had to have a special, your K-cup that you're using has to have a special, some type of printed ink or some type of something on there that the newer Keurig machines would recognize and say, oh, this is an authentic 2.0, K-cup, and so it'll brew it. Otherwise, it would say, no, you have to get a compatible cup. So there was so much backlash against that that they did away with it, and there were even some K-cup manufacturers that were distributing to people a little clip that you could put on your Keurig 2.0 machine, and that was the argument there was that circumventing a technological measure. So it's definitely interesting. I think a lot of what we're going to rely on here is consumer pushback in a lot of these cases, and the public outcry that would come about when this really start these types of laws are being used to control how consumers are using the devices they buy in their everyday life.
Yeah, you brought up the right to tinker. It's actually exactly that issue Virgil brought up in the chat, that this was came up earlier with the John Deere tractors. I remember we talked about some months ago. But yeah, you know, basically the issue is software. As our devices are becoming smarter and as software is becoming embedded in everything, suddenly copyright through the DMCA becomes a way that the manufacturers can effectively control how the consumers can use their devices. So I think this is a great challenge. You know, this is something that has sort of been a thorn in the side of, you know, tinkerers everywhere for years. And the EFF has argued against Section 1201 for a long time. So I definitely wish them the best of luck. Maybe I'll be able to contribute a little to something to this in a few months. Mike, do you have anything to add?
You know, I more in the form of a question. My recollection is that Section 1201 was, and this was a number of years ago now, but Section 1201 was already challenged on First Amendment grounds in the Corley decision. And I think that was somewhere maybe out of the Southern District of New York, or maybe it went all the way up to the Second Circuit. I don't recall. But I do recall that it's been upheld. The court found that it did pass constitutional muster. So curious if anybody thinks that you know, the facts are now so different as a result of technological advances that the First Amendment somehow is implicated in a different way than it was back 15 years ago or so when it was first challenged under First Amendment grounds.
I think actually, yeah. Sorry, Colette, if you take it away.
Oh, I was just thinking as you were speaking and describing the case and then this further discussion about when, you know, sort of stepping back a notch, when is it best for a movement to seek a legislative change versus using the courts? And what's funny is in college, my college thesis was about this. I'm like going back in my brain, what was the theory? No, but there's social movements. And when do you take the court route? And when do you take a more policy legislative route to try to solve your problem? And EFF is highly, highly skilled in making, you know, those calls. That's their whole job, basically, in their efforts. So it's really interesting that they've now's the time in their mind to go the court route. To me, I find that an interesting sort of, I'd love to unpack and learn, you know, why now? But my hunch is we've had now three or four of maybe more. I guess if they're every 3 years and it's been almost 20 years, there's been many of these triennial events at the Copyright Office for, you know, figuring out what is in the exemption and what is not. And maybe they feel like there's a record now that is ripe to build an argument. And I'm actually unfortunately not familiar, and I'm glad to hear about the other case that Michael just mentioned from New York on this, because I didn't know that there had already been a challenge. At least sitting here today, I didn't remember that. But so it's interesting how this might, the record here might be very, very different from what was in that prior case. And maybe they feel like the the court climate is more open. We have many more years of copyright cases that have happened in this time, that just educate the judges a bit more on what this copyright stuff is all about. And I'm also thinking vibe in the U.S., at least right now, about this freedom to tinker. As we have all these other tools and as people, you know, computer literacy and the ability to use your computers for so many other things, more and more and more people will get this problem. They understand it. It's very tangible to them. But I also wonder, you know, we live in this world. We're a little echo chamber of our own in a way. So we see, obviously, this is a copyright problem. But how many people, when they use their whatever device for the first time or the umpteenth time, their K-cup or their garage remote controller or whatever, ever stop to think, oh, it's copyright that's preventing me from being able to do whatever I want to do? I don't know that the average person who's not, you know, super interested in this makes that connection right away. So those are just observations.
I think that the fact that the average person doesn't make that connection may be a hint that copyright isn't the right way to be going about this kind of control. Just to your issue earlier, or your question earlier about the case that Mike was bringing up, if I remember correctly, Universal v. Corley, I think that that had to do with the publishing just of feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that that was the publishing of maybe the HD DVD key or one of the keys that would decrypt.
That case.
I think
the
that's
DVD,
right.
Is it the DVD CCA case?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, good.
But effectively, for our listeners, DVD players are protected, are region protected around the world so that only DVDs of a specific region can be played in your device. The only thing that's preventing that is a key that is distributed by the people that manufactured the DVDs. And in 2002, I want to say, a hacker magazine got hold of the key, either through reverse engineering or leaking it or something, but they just published in plain text the word, you know, the letters, the string of letters and numbers. I remember there were some T-shirts being made about it, but, you know, with that string of letters and numbers, you could play any DVD you wanted on your DVD player. I think that the distinguishing that case from this one may be a little easy because I think that's a pretty clear circumvention of technological protective measures. They've got, I think, some better victims in their case here. I have to pull up, I think, Matthew Green and Andrew Huang. But they're both security researchers and very, very smart tinkerers. Matthew, I think, wants to be able to do security research on voting machines, on VPNs, on products that would be that are, you know, geared towards consumer privacy, but that he has been unable to do so because of the chilling effects of Section 1201. And I think that Andrew Huang has specifically a product that is sort of a product embodying the earlier Corley sort of example, where rather than it's just the code that would decrypt these devices, he has a device that he'd like to sell that uses a similar kind of circumvention so that you can get around some of the protective measures on HDMI. So this little device, I think, if I understand it correctly, would allow you to plug it directly into your TV and plug the HDMI cable into that and then overlay video on your HDMI feed, which I think is some kind of circumvention of the TPM surrounding that that connection. And both of them are prevented from selling or doing this type of research. So, you know, when we're talking about sort of, you know, feeling the pulse of how the public is feeling about this, I think that those are two examples where, you know, it's much easier to make the argument that these TPMs are having a chilling effect on what otherwise would be protected speech. It's not just, you know, as much, ha, you guys have this password, and now, right, you know, the password is out.
I mean, it certainly seems like there's a very significant distinction between what was going on in Corley and what's going on here in the Green Challenge. But aren't they challenging it not as applied, but aren't they challenging it on its face, meaning that yes, it would be unconstitutional under the First Amendment regardless of the circumstances? Or am I wrong on that? Is it more narrow?
If I read their complaint correctly, yes, they are saying that it's facially unconstitutional. They're saying that the triennial rulemaking process is also unconstitutional because of the ways that it sort of places the onus of proving responsibility.
It's like a prior restraint.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, the question that I have, I mean, and those guys, I agree with what Colette was saying. It's a very skilled, very smart people, great lawyers with that organization. But what's the alternative here? I mean, if 1201 is unconstitutional, I mean, that could be a pretty significant problem for a lot of content owners. I mean, you know, I agree that there's definitely some pretty major restrictions, but if we throw it out the window completely, boy, I'm not sure that I like the result associated with that.
Yeah. And this, I wanted to go ahead and go back to a little bit of what Colette said about how there's a huge issue with how dated these laws are. And it's not just in this industry in my industry that I work in, the entertainment industry. We recently had like a huge group of artists coming out about another section of the DMCA for the safe harbor provision. Obviously, Taylor Swift was one of the artists. And other ones include Paul McCartney, Carole King, Kings of Leon. Basically, all these artists are coming out and saying that the safe harbor provisions that were initially enacted years ago for basically for tech companies to have some type of protection back when they were just starting out, it's kind of dated. And now we have these huge tech companies that are making huge profits off of the ability to, as some might argue, and you probably know my viewpoint without me saying anything, but being able to hide behind the takedown measures and all of that. So there, I think going back to what EFF is doing here, I think it's pretty clear, even if obviously we don't know what the outcome of this case is going to be, if it's going to be seen as violation of the First Amendment. But if that happens, then that's clearly, either way, it's a clear wake-up call and more attention that's being drawn to the lack of updates and how old the DMCA is and how it's really, in a lot of circumstances, just not working and not providing the tools that are needed in a wide variety of industries. So I think that's the best takeaway that I would pull from this, even if it doesn't go anywhere, is the fact that it's yet another stone being thrown at how old the DMCA is.
And yeah, imperfect, I mean, but very important.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I think you see, particularly with the DMCA, the opposing forces at play here. You've got, obviously, on the one side, the content owners, and then you've got other folks that will want to be able to have access to that content for research and other reasons. I mean, they're both certainly legitimate. And Colette, to your point, maybe that's why the EFF wanted to go the judicial route, because at the legislative level, especially with copyright, there's so many different opposing forces and so many different interests involved. It can be difficult. There's a lot of lobbying. It can take a long time. Whereas, you know, the judicial route can be more expeditious.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you that the legislative route is difficult, or can be myriad. And especially in the copyright space, it opens sort of the Pandora's box of what is the scope of re-looking at the Copyright Act. I have to be a little careful, and we forgot at the beginning of my hour with you remind everyone, although my day job is with a major tech company, Microsoft, you know, I'm not here speaking at all on their behalf, so I have to be mindful of that in this conversation. But yeah, I mean, the prospect of reopening the Copyright Act has been on the radar of anybody who has a pulse in copyright for many years. I know Pamela Samuelson at Berkeley has convened a group of people a few years ago to think hard about this. There was testimony, I don't know, I think it was 2013, maybe early 2014 I think before the Judiciary Committee, where she spoke, other people from tech and other parts of copyright industries, to talk about, you know, what is the future of the Copyright Act and where should it be going? But this is going to be a 20-year legislative process, potentially, if things are going to really be reopened and changed. So, yeah, I guess the oddly, you know, sometimes going the court route is faster. And this is one of those cases, but it's also kind of a blunt instrument. And if a court comes out and rules, yeah, the whole thing is unconstitutional, it really changes the playing field about whether new legislation needs to be proposed to fix some of that. And this could also be a strategic play to get rights holders to the table to have a more meaningful conversation. I don't know. I don't know what EFF's all up motives are, but they do have unique, you know, plaintiffs that I think, especially in the voting machine situation, right? One of them was a voting.
There are some exemptions already outlined, I think, in the last rulemaking process. The EFF is saying that the rulemaking that not all of the exemptions that they requested were granted, and that the ones that weren't requested would still be permitted speech that was, you know, prohibited, I guess, or chilled from the DMCA, Section 1201. Just to Mike's point, I agree, you know, getting rid of 1201 entirely, I think, is – you know, kind of a frightening idea. Not really sure how that would shake out. I do want to say that in their prayers for relief, they're simply asking for a declaration that the anti-circumvention and anti-trafficking rules, Section 1201, are facially overbroad in violation of the First Amendment, and then a declaration that the rulemaking processes are also facially unlawful prior restraint and licensing regime in violation of the First Amendment. They have obviously other prayers, but it looks like they don't propose an alternative as much as they just say, look, this is a problem and it needs to be fixed. So,
yeah, I mean, to me, that's you're asking a court to engage in a massive overhaul of a big piece of legislation where there's lots and lots at stake. You know, I think a court's going to be pretty loath to find that a statute is facially violating the First Amendment in this context. You know, you contrast this to a recent case in the trademark context, the Simon Tam case at the Federal Circuit, where they found that a portion of the Lanham Act violated the First Amendment and was invalid as a result. But there you're dealing with something that's not as significant to various interests. But here, I mean, it would be amazing, and I don't think amazing in a good way, if 1201 just completely disappeared. So I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to follow this case and see what happens.
Definitely, we'll keep following it. In just a little bit, we're going to move on to some patent issues. But before that, I think we're going to have to say goodbye to Colette, who has to run. So Colette, thank you so much for joining us today. You brought up some of the stuff that Without My Consent is doing earlier, some of the awesome work you guys are doing. If there's anything else you want to plug, it's all yours.
Oh, well, thank you. No, it's fun to be on the show. It's fun to catch up with you. And, you know, we'd love everyone's support for Without My Consent. We're entirely donation driven in addition to our grant. And, you know, we just really appreciate the support of the Twill audience in our work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, listeners, you heard him. Go donate. Go pay attention.
All right. Thanks so much, Colette.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Thanks.
Bye.
Take care.
All right. So before we move into some patent issues and the rest of the show, let's hear a little bit from our sponsor, Wealthfront, from Denise.
Thanks so much, Emery and Mike. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Wealthfront. You invest for the long term for you or your family's financial health. But trying to do that yourself, especially the right way, is complex and time consuming. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees, between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, and no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. Unlike other financial advisors, Wealthfront won't bog you down with dozens of questions. They've simplified their risk identification process, which allows you to begin investing sooner. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. It goes right to work, monitoring your portfolios around the clock, and takes action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront portfolios are based on modern portfolio theory and are designed to adjust according to your personal risk tolerance while staying diversified and tax efficient. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts that they'll provide in a summary of all your assets. You can see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard on your desktop or with their mobile app. Wealthfront recently introduced their 529 college savings plan, allowing you to invest after-tax dollars much like a Roth IRA and save for your child or grandchild's higher education expenses. Wealthfront manages about $3 billion in client assets, and it's growing rapidly every day. What are you waiting for? Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit wealthfront.com/twill to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at wealthfront.com/twill.
All right. Thank you, Denise, for that. Magically stopping in to give us a nice advertising spot. I know I said patents earlier, but I do want to make sure we squeeze in a couple articles about Hollywood music and entertainment. So if you could, please, studio, roll the bumper. Franklin, was that one of the ones that you did as well?
Yes. Yes, that is.
Brilliant.
Those are great. All right. So we do have I wanted to segue into this issue while we were talking about the DMCA. You guys might have heard about a bit of a DMCA gaffe earlier this week the anti-piracy group Remove Your Media had on their website. Apparently what happened was that in response to Lumen Database, which is a database that is a publicly created database of DMCA takedown requests. Essentially, they will archive any DMCA request that they are – or any DMCA takedown request that they receive. They remove personally identifiable information, though, and it's supposed to serve as a public service database so people can know which parties are sending huge amounts of DMCA takedowns. In response, the anti-piracy group Remove Your Media launched a campaign and a database of their own that, in their words, made accountability works both ways, I think is the tweet. Transparency works both ways now. What they did was they basically set themselves up as the mirror database to Lumen. They will take any counter notices that are sent to them and post the information about the person that filed the counter notice. Now, we are reporting on this on Friday, August 5th, and by now they have removed a lot of the really awful, egregious privacy violations that they were posting. But I'm sure that there's a screenshot available to show that at the time they were posting not just the name, but the street address, the country of origin, the email address, and the phone number, in addition to the claim that any person was making. Another one of the elements of the imperfect DMCA is the entire sort of procedure, the takedown process. And obviously there's a lot of interests on both sides of this. I don't really have much more to add to that. Mike, Franklin, do you have anything to say?
Emery, I have a question. I mean, I did read the article, but I want to make sure I understand, and more importantly, that the listeners understand. So under the DMCA regime, of course, you've got the notice and takedown, which initially starts the process of getting the content taken down. But right. We're not talking about that notice. We're talking about the counter notice, which is from the alleged infringer, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And so the alleged infringer, the alleged infringer then responds to the notice – saying, no, you shouldn't take it down. You should put it back up, right?
Right, exactly. So this would be, for example, in YouTube, have Content ID would flag your video. Maybe you're just a YouTuber that, didn't infringe, but the Content ID system flagged it automatically. If you were to click the button that says, file a counterclaim automatically, that counterclaim would be filed sent to the person that had originally filed the takedown notice. And at that point, those people or that party would then send that counterclaim to the remove your media database.
Got it. So whoever the ISP was would then be sending that counter notice to this third party that would then publish the information.
Right. Yes.
Okay. So I don't believe there's any, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is there anything under the DMCA that prohibits the ISP from sending that information along?
No, I don't think so. Not that I'm aware of, at least. I don't think that there's anything prohibiting the creation of Lumen database, publicly submitted database of takedown requests that you receive. I don't think that there is any prohibition against, creating a public database of counter notices that you've received, regardless of how those are submitted. The issue really here was just sort of a vindictive politics issue. This group obviously had a axe to grind, and they were upset that transparency, I think, was working against them. So in their words, they sent out a tweet that says transparency works both ways now after they created this database. And unlike the responsible to Lumen database, they were pretty irresponsible about the way they displayed this information.
Interesting. Yeah, so I guess the threat being what? That if you provide a counter notification, this may discourage you from filing a counter notification, knowing that that information is going to be disclosed to the public potentially? All of your personal information, your street address, name, email address, all that?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely the implication of this. I mean, there was Remove Your Media has since taken down a lot of that extremely identifiable information. If they received that, identifiable information from the counterclaim process automatically, if that was sort of baked into YouTube's content ID system, for example, then, yeah, I could see that might have a chilling effect if you are worried that simply by, contesting a takedown request, that your information could be plastered all over the internet. The Torrent Freak article that we have up here said that, this guy that was named here and outed was just a YouTuber that something like 2 years ago had, contested a claim against them, which happens, again, we were talking about earlier, millions of times a month. It's sort of the intersection of these automated systems dealing with the DMCA and the inadequacies of the DMCA takedown process, I think.
In my experience, coming from the side of a person that sends on behalf of a company, and if I haven't already said it, I know Colette probably mentioned this, but for me, these are all my personal opinions. I'm not representing my company. But in my experience in having to send DMCA takedown notices, pretty much every single major company or website that I've sent them to, I include a little line that says, like a lot of them, like GitHub, I know, for instance, they send it on to the what's the new name of the website? Sorry, I just remember. What was the website where you can view?
Lumen. Database?
Yeah, Lumen. So they include something that says, like, if you want us to redact your personal information, or they automatically redact it. But I always include an extra line that says, if they are going to send it onto a public database like that to redact my contact information, my email address, and the address. But otherwise, I think it's just a mutual respect thing. And so it's kind of amazing that in this counter notice situation, this was handled this way is absolutely bizarre. And, obviously very embarrassing for the side of the industry that is it's just embarrassing. Yeah. So.
Yeah. All right. So actually, I do want to take the time to use our first MCLE passphrase of the day. How about we go with embarrassing DMCA, all one word, low caps. For people listening for extended legal education, we use these passphrases essentially so that whoever is checking against you can confirm that you've listened to our show and that you didn't just put them in afterwards. So first CLE passphrase is embarrassing DMCA. Thanks, chat, for reminding me. Let me write that down before I forget. All right. So I don't think I really have anything else to add to that issue. I I think, Franklin, you hit it on the nail on the head. It's more embarrassing, I think, for the parties involved than anything else. But yeah, moving forward to another bit of DMCA takedowns. We've talked before about people sending takedown requests to Google, for example, for showing links to torrents. Warner Brothers, in this article, has filed another DMCA takedown notice, except this time to the subreddit Best of Streaming Video. So this is a subreddit on Reddit that is dedicated to collecting links to streaming videos, not the actual videos themselves. And Warner Brothers has filed a takedown notice on these people as well. I don't really have much to add to this. Does anyone else care to comment?
Yeah, I don't think so. Nope. From here, Franklin?
Yeah, so in my opinion, and obviously, as the article mentions, it's very strange that they would send it to Google and try to get the entire subreddit blocked, but instead of just the individual post. But one of the interesting aspects of this, it brings up the issue, kind of like what we saw, if you remember the Grokster case, which is kind of hard not to remember if you ever go to law school or just know anything about copyright law. But I think there's an interesting argument that could be made here regarding contributory infringement and whether this linking to, I know it's not really settled yet, or whether it's infringement or contributory infringement to link to places that are either streaming or offering downloads of copyrighted content. But I think that's an interesting viewpoint to take here, is whether by posting in this subreddit, you are contributorily infringing the copyrighted works by basically shouting and providing a way to get access to something that is clearly still copyrighted, if it's something like a movie or something like that.
Hmm. Well, I think that's about all I've got for this. So let's move forward to one of our last articles on Hollywood music and entertainment. This is an article on the TMCA.com blog that obviously Mike Keyes is part of, from Anna Miller, published an article, "Is Music Sampling Back in Vogue?" Mike, do you want to take a little bit of this?
Yeah, sure. So this is a case that was recently decided by the Ninth Circuit, dealing with the issue of dealing with the issue of music sampling. So we've talked previously about the Sixth Circuit decision, and we were kind of alluding to it earlier today in our discussion. The Bridgeport Music case out of the Sixth Circuit held that any amount of sampling is actionable. There's no such thing as the de minimis defense in the context of sampling a piece of music. So irrespective of how long or how short that particular sample is, that is actionable in the Sixth Circuit and a violation of copyright. So essentially the Ninth Circuit had to deal with the exact issue in one of Madonna's songs that the name of it escapes me, but she apparently sampled a very short snippet of a horn, as I recall, some horn riff that appeared in her song. So the claim that was copyright infringement. And so the Ninth Circuit was dealing with the exact issue that was faced by Bridgeport Music in the Sixth Circuit, which is that a per se violation of the Copyright Act and that there's no de minimis copying defense. And the Ninth Circuit comes out the other way and said no, that it rejected the Sixth Circuit approach, that there is the de minimis defense in these types of cases. So so now we do have an express split between two circuits, Sixth Circuit saying de minimis copying in the context of music sampling is that defense is not available, and the Ninth Circuit saying it absolutely is. So that's essentially the rundown on the recent Madonna case.
Well, that's great. Obviously, we've talked about the problems with de minimis takings for music sampling before. What is the, I guess, procedurally, the next thing that we should be following? I mean, do you think that this is going to, since there's obviously been created a clear split, do you think this is an issue that the Supremes might hear in the near-ish future?
You know, I mean, certainly there would be an argument, a pretty decent argument, that it's something that the court should take up, particularly given that it's dealing with digital sampling and this issue isn't going to go away. So maybe, you know, we've got some other interesting copyright cases that are wending their way through the court. Actually, one was just recently decided on the issue of attorney's fees under the Copyright Act. But then the other one is the varsity cheerleading case that the Supreme Court will be dealing with next term. So I don't know. Certainly it would get my vote to add this one to the list, assuming that the non-prevailing party in the Ninth Circuit petitions for review.
All right. Well, I think that that is an issue that we will definitely be following in the future. I don't think that I think it's pretty clear how we all stand on this. Unless, Franklin, do you have anything to add to this? Sorry.
No. I think everything that was said was excellent. But one point that's interesting is the rise in all of the basically older songs are now facing litigation. So it's kind of, if I was a songwriter or a musician, I would kind of wonder whether instead of spending the profits I make from the product I release, whether I should be setting aside in a trust the money so that if the event and maybe, I don't know when Madonna's, 1990 is when Vogue came out, but 20, 30 years later, I might get sued over something that was in the song. It's definitely interesting, in my opinion, that a lot of copyright cases now are older songs that are just coming back to and finding new life in litigation.
I think that was interesting from like a public perception view. You're right. You know, a lot of these cases are coming up that are just dealing with ancient settled issues. You know, I think that might, at least, you know, public perception wise, shift the narrative against these kind of cases. Like eventually people are going to get tired of seeing these ridiculous arguments, right? Like, I don't know. Maybe that's just me opining and hopeful. But
I think that's great.
No, I mean, to remind our listeners as to why we're probably dealing with these sorts of cases now, back in 2014, in a case involving the movie Raging Bull, the Supreme Court said that the defense of laches does not apply in the context of copyright infringement claims. And laches is essentially a defense saying if you've waited too long to enforce your rights, you're going to be precluded from enforcing your rights in federal court. And for years, that defense of laches applied in the context of copyright claims. The Supreme Court said it's no longer available. It's not something that's provided for under the Copyright Act. So what we've seen now is we've seen some cases where the alleged act of infringement initially occurred years and in some cases decades ago, and the plaintiff is no longer precluded from bringing a claim. The most recent example that we've seen is in the Led Zeppelin case, where this alleged copying by Led Zeppelin occurred 40 years ago, give or take a few years. Yet the plaintiff or the estate of the copyright owner was able to bring the claim for copyright infringement 40 years later because laches didn't apply. So I suspect that that same rationale and reasoning may have been at play in the Madonna case. And I think you guys are right. We're probably going to see more and more of this, not just necessarily in music, but probably in the context of other copyright claims, because laches is no longer an available defense and you can enforce your rights many, many years after the act of infringement has taken place.
Adding to that, I also think it's important that the Supreme Court has decided to take up this issue in patent infringement cases. So they've basically taken the court decision that you mentioned, the Petrella case, and are applying it. It's the SCA Hygiene v. First Quality Baby Products. So, and I actually heard all of this at a CLE I went to in Nashville a couple of days ago, but that's how I don't know anything about patents, so I'll just say that up front. But I do know that they are at least reviewing the same principle of law in the Supreme Court this fall. So that'll be interesting to see if we see the same issue in these same types of cases now happening in patent.
Right. You know, Franklin, it's interesting that we're seeing that, you know, with the Roberts Court, we're seeing some parallels here between the various branches of IP, at least in to my way of thinking. You know, the court in Octane Fitness in 2014, that was a patent case involving attorney's fees, award of attorney's fees under the Patent Act. We saw just recently this last term in June, the court decided the issue of attorney's fees under the Copyright Act. We've dealt with laches in the copyright context, and now we're dealing with laches in the context of the Patent Act. So we're definitely seeing the court taking up similar issues between the various IP statutes, and frankly, seeing some harmonization between the two. I think the standard that the court set for attorney's fees under the Patent Act in Octane Fitness certainly harmonizes and is consistent with what the court later did in the most recent case, in the Wiley case involving a award of attorney's fees under the Copyright Act. So just interesting to note that.
Definitely. Well, we've got one last article from the TMCA blog in this section before we move on to patents and then social web. But I wanted to highlight the fact, the article Campaign IP Violations Part 3, Huckabee Campaign Pays Up. So, yeah, Mike, I mean, you're welcome to cover this if you want. I think it's super
interesting. Sure. I'll do it. We've been pretty active in covering these various IP violations in this election cycle. It's actually been great. We haven't covered all of them by any stretch. But this was one that certainly caught our attention. So the backstory on this, you all remember, it was probably, I don't know, close to a year ago now, maybe even longer, shorter, somewhere in there, there was a Kentucky clerk, Kim Davis, a county clerk that was responsible for issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. She was, and not just same-sex, she was responsible, the county official, for issuing marriage licenses. She refused to issue them to same-sex couples, and ultimately she was ordered to do so by, I believe, the federal court. She refused to do so and I think spent some time in jail. So Mike Huckabee, of course, was running for president at the time. What he did is he held a rally in support of Kim Davis, kind of welcoming her out of jail. And during the course of this rally, he played Eye of the Tiger, the very famous, well-known song from Rocky III, written by Survivor. So ultimately, he was sued for copyright infringement, or his campaign was sued for copyright infringement, claiming that they didn't have the necessary public performance license to perform this song at the campaign rally. So Huckabee responds formally to the complaint. I think it was filed in the Northern District of Illinois, and interposed an interesting defense, which is under Section 110 of the Copyright Act. It is a exception to a claim of infringement if you are performing a musical work during a religious assembly. So what Governor Huckabee said is, look, this was not a campaign stunt. This was a religious assembly where we were all gathered. I'm an ordained minister. This is Governor Huckabee talking, of course. I'm an ordained minister, and there was a prayer at the beginning. And this was, for all intents and purposes, even though it was in the great outdoors, it was a religious assembly, and therefore we're exempt under Section 110, and the claim needs to go away. So interesting argument. I gotta give it to the Huckabee team. But what ultimately led to their undoing is the expenses associated with that event were claimed as part of an expense of the Huckabee campaign. And so that was unearthed by plaintiff's legal team, and they were able to show that, look, this was not a religious assembly. This was a campaign event for your presidential campaign, and here we've got the line item on your disclosure statement to show it. So ultimately entered into a confidential settlement. But that confidential settlement itself was also listed on the Huckabee campaign expense sheet, which also became public. So he was kind of done in a couple of different ways here in this case. So interesting, fun IP violation that was exposed and litigated for a little while here.
Yeah, maybe if you're going to claim it's a religious ceremony, don't write it off as a campaign activity for your taxes. pro tip.
Yeah, you know, the statutory provision at issue, I mean, I haven't researched it to any great extent, but I do know that, you know, it seems like there's an argument that it would only apply to liturgical works. But I think NIMR or some other authorities have come out saying actually that section 110 exception applies to any musical work. It doesn't have to be a liturgical work of any sort. So it was an interesting defense, and had it not clearly been a campaign rally, as shown by the expense sheet, you know, would have been interesting for a court to decide the issue. I'm kind of bummed that it didn't get an actual judicial decision.
I think that's fascinating. I never heard of that exemption. So you're telling me that if I had like a Jesus camp, then I could just play any music I want all the time?
I don't know that I'd say that that's the that that's
and
the,
like recorded those situations. Things, made those videos on the internet.
Yeah, it's all right. It's interesting. Performance of a, let me see, this is under section 110 of the Copyright Act, and we're talking about, let me see, performance of a non-dramatic literary or musical work, of a dramatico musical work of a religious nature, or display of a work in the course of services at a place of worship or other religious assembly. Now, what I believe NIMR says is, well, it says a literary or musical work, which is separate, or of a dramatico musical work of a religious nature. So I think what the argument is if it's just a musical work, that would be an exception. You can actually do a music dramatic work of a religious nature. That would also fall within the exception. So, So it's interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. I don't think that we have anything else for that. So how about we call the next MCLE and final MCLE passphrase for the day liturgical copyright? Because if you don't have to write a four-syllable word, then you're not really doing any work. So liturgical copyright is our second MCLE passphrase of the day. If you'd like more information about our MCLE passphrases, you can go to wiki.twit.tv/shows/thisweekinlaw, I believe, or just search for This Week in Law Wiki, and we've got some information on how you can use those MCLE passphrases there. So I think that wraps up our Hollywood music and entertainment section. We just have two more brief articles before we wrap up the show, but that means two more bumpers. So bring on the patent bumpers, please. Awesome. Franklin, thank you so much for making those bumpers. They make me smile every single time.
I think I had too much time in my free time after a 1L year when I was interning with Denise and Evan. So that was the result.
Free time. I'll get some of that one day. But this article I just wanted to touch on. I know none of us are necessarily patent experts, but it definitely intersects with some of the stuff we were talking about earlier on trollish behaviors. Blockstream promises not to abuse patents. So Blockstream is a Bitcoin – well, I think they're a blockchain startup, and they have done the very encouraging act of affirmatively making statements on their website that they're going to try very, very hard not to be patent trolls. So they've adopted the patent pledge, promising that they will only use their software patents defensively. They've shared their patents under the defensive patent license, which is something I don't know if we've gotten much chance to talk about, but it's a very interesting, cool attempt to deal with the problem of patent trolls. And they've also introduced their patents under a modified version of the innovators patent agreement. So I did some digging into the innovators patent agreement. Absolutely amazing. Did anyone else happen to take a look at that? So the innovators patent agreement is essentially you can tell that it borrows some of their inspiration from the Creative Commons licenses. But cleverly, the innovators patent agreement, I think, is a project spun out of something some work at Twitter, if I'm not mistaken. But essentially what it does, it allows patent holders to place a license on their website that allows for anyone else to use their patents defensively. The crux of it, the real clever bit, though, is that so they're openly licensing their patents. But if someone uses their patents and then attempts to wield their patents by shutting down someone else, they are able to the original inventors are able to go and grant licenses to use the patents to whoever they wish. I'm not sure if I clearly outlined that, but essentially imagine the case where I'm a patent holder. I would like my patents to be used in defensive, non-trollish ways. So I have this innovator's agreement on my website. Other person, you know, troll A comes to my website and begins using my patents and then institutes or starts using that patent pretty aggressively to try to shut down competitors. I could then, the original inventor, could see that this troll is doing this and say, wait, the patent that you're trying to wield is one I originally own, and I'm just going to go ahead and grant a license to the patent to the person that you are wielding it against. So it allows the original inventors to sort of have control over who eventually has licenses to their work, to their patents, specifically to try to discourage the phenomenon of patent trolls. So I don't know if anyone else thought that was clever, but I really did.
No, I think it's clever for sure, but I'm not sure that I totally understand it. Is it that the original patentee, if he or she assigned it, that they have essentially a license back to – I guess, still have control over it somehow? How does that work, Emery?
So I have to dig into this, to be honest. I'm looking through the language, and again, the version that Blockchain has posted is a sort of modified version of the original Innovators Agreement license that was, I think, a project of some very smart people at Twitter. But let's see. Yeah, so the company on behalf of itself and its successors agree not to assert any claims of any patents which may be granted on any of the above applications unless asserted for a defensive purpose. So essentially they're allowed to wield these wield patents defensively, but if claims are asserted against an entity that has filed, maintained, threatened, or voluntarily participated in any patent infringement lawsuit against the assignee or a patent infringement lawsuit against assignees, users, etc., then the original inventor, I'm trying to find the language here, is able to essentially assign that license to the person that they're wielding it against. Hmm. And you know what? I think that you might have revealed that maybe my understanding of this is not as crystal as it could be. So I'll definitely try to get someone on the show that can dig down into the weeds of this. But, you know, as someone that is only in patent law class, is not a barred attorney or practicing patent attorney, it certainly seemed like an interesting, innovative way of dealing with the patent troll problem.
No, it sounds very interesting. I definitely would be interested in studying up on it a bit more myself, and definitely we should look to have somebody on the show that could give us a little bit more information on it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, that is all the patent news we have. So let's wind up with one last article from the social web. Studio, could you roll that bumper, please? All right. Well, we would be remiss to forget to note that there has been a lawsuit filed in about Pokemon Go. If you missed This Week in Law's very special Pokemon Go dedicated episode a few weeks ago, go tune in. It's a good one, I thought. But essentially, a New Jersey man has sued Pokemon Go and Niantic for nuisance and alleging a class action suit. Not much to add to it now. If anyone else has dug into it and has any points to contribute, I'm happy to hear them. But we wanted to make sure to mention to our listeners.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because within a matter of days of Pokemon Go, the app coming out, Keith Lee, who's an attorney in Alabama, runs the blog associatesmind.com. He wrote an article and it was called "Is Pokemon Go Illegal?" And I thought that was it details pretty much everything or one of the things that's happening in this recent lawsuit that was just filed. So great foresight in that. But I think that article gives a great rundown and analysis from kind of, I guess, the best way to describe it is if you're a law student and you have this as a hypothetical or a question on an essay exam, that's essentially what this article does. And so that's one of the things is whether this this is encouraging people, this augmented reality app is encouraging people to trespass and encouraging people to go onto other people's lands without permission, or if it's creating attractive nuisances. A lot of those 1L terms that you hear as a law student are definitely making their way back with augmented reality apps. But it'll be very interesting to see, and very interesting to see how much the company, the developer, Niantic, and Pokemon, the company, rely on the terms of service and that all users are agreeing to. So, I mean, they've obviously increased the app in terms of the number of notices you get now saying to be aware of where you're walking so you don't cross over borders or anything like that. But it'll be interesting to see how this goes.
Yeah, I did want to say that, you know, the issue here was obviously that Pokestops or PokeGyms were being placed on private property, not public property. In this case, it was a man's home that became a Pokestop, and he was, you know, alarmed to see that obviously people were coming up and pointing camera phones at his house, and a couple of people apparently came up and asked him permission to go into his backyard to capture a Pokemon. But you know, something that I saw in the complaint that is sort of interesting in this case, you know, you're looking for the smoking gun. Well, on Niantic's or Pokemon Go's website, they say, and I'm just going to read from this, but they say, if you can't get to the Pokestop because it's on private property, there'll be more just around the corner. So don't worry, which I think is, you know, they definitely screenshotted that. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting case to follow. We'll definitely be paying attention and keeping listeners up to breast on that issue as it evolves.
Trespass laws definitely back in vogue, apparently. So
yeah. And, you know, I think the augmented reality, we've really just started to scratch the surface of that. It is definitely like, you know, Pokemon Go is exactly what augmented reality app designers like Niantic before they were making Pokemon Go had always talked about, you know, the idea of overlaying information on absolutely everything. And yeah, the augmented reality and trespassing and nuisances. It's going to be fascinating issues to follow.
Yeah, for sure. So there's one other facet to this, not necessarily related to trespass, but I did read an article the other day, and Franklin and Emery, I don't know if you saw it as well, but there was some flap about how in the terms of service associated with the Pokemon Go app that you are agreeing by downloading it to mandatory arbitration. I don't know if there was some sort of opt-out provision or something, but in any event, I know that seems to be a point of controversy, given that there is all this talk about these various lawsuits and people being injured as a result of playing their Pokemon Go in the car or otherwise not paying attention as they're walking down the street, that all of these claims, at least to the extent that you downloaded the app, potentially are going to be subject to mandatory arbitration, assuming that that arbitration provision is valid and enforceable. FYI.
In the terms of service, there is an email address provided to opt out of the arbitration provision. However, you have to do it within 30 days of accepting the terms, which is essentially as soon as you open the app and create the account. So from the time you start playing, you have 30 days to email the company. You can just go to Niantic. If you go to their website, you can find or Google it, you can find the terms and find all that information built into the terms of service. But yeah, they do provide a provision and a way to opt out of the arbitration.
But Mike, I think that's a really interesting point. The specific locality of augmented reality issues with mandatory arbitration clauses. You know, if those type of issues come up, I can think of a couple contract professors I know that would love for the issue of mandatory arbitration clauses to, you know, get a little more public attention.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that type of arbitration provision would not be applicable or enforceable vis-a-vis this property owner. Of course, they could say, look, I've never downloaded the app. I'm not subject to it. And, you know, the fact that there is this opt-out provision, I assume that they probably did that because without an opt-out provision, you know, a court may look at that and say this is, you know, a contract of adhesion that, you know, you left no room for the consumer to negotiate. They were forced to arbitrate. So probably a pretty smart move to provide an opt-out mechanism for consumers.
Yeah, yeah. An interesting point, I guess. I just looked and realized today's date. The game came out because I remember it wasn't out on July 4th, but it was out like right after that. I think it came out on the 6th. So 30 days. I don't know.
Yeah, it might be the last day if you started on launch day.
Exactly.
So, okay.
Bonus resource of the day. Listeners, if you want out of your arbitration clauses, shoot an email to Niantic today.
Is that who they have to contact?
Yes. Yeah. The email address is termsofservice@nianticlabs.com, or you can put it in the mail, but I don't know. I don't think you want to try to prove when you put it in the mail, that kind of yet again, 1L contract law basics.
So,
the mailbox rule.
Exactly.
Sorry if I could chime in really quick. On Saturday we had these guys on the new screensavers.
Oh, cool.
Essentially it's an augmented reality, like laser tag kind of thing. So if a lot of these things are coming to light about Pokemon Go, I'm wondering if this one becomes a hit.
That is amazing.
Are we going to have the same issues?
So is it an add-on? It looks like they have something on their phone.
Yes. But it's essentially laser tag. But like, as you can see here, like they're going to include drones.
What?
And stuff like
that.
Oh, man,
that is so cool.
Oh, yeah. That's brilliant.
That is amazing.
For our listeners that are not streaming, I know I listen to this show exclusively before starting to work here, so you might not be – we have definitely a population that aren't watching the stream. But, yeah, there's a very cool promo video of a sort of augmented reality laser tag app on the screen, and they just showed someone picking up an Oculus dev kit virtual reality headset and piloting a drone that can then play with the individual players on the street. Super cool.
So which episode of the Screensavers? Did you say Screensavers?
Yes, this past weekend, I believe.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Oh, and yeah, someone, Neo in the chat, I just want to drop this. While we're talking about Niantic, Niantic's CEO was hacked on Twitter with an abysmal password. So my tip is to not use passwords like password 123. Put that out there. All right. So we are going to wrap up the show now. I think we've had an excellent show. We've got a selfie of the week, a couple tips and resources, and then I think it's a wrap. So you mind rolling that excellent animal selfie of the week promo? Air bumper. All right. So I have talked about this basically every single time the animal selfie has been brought up, about how I want to make a machine that will train animals to want to take a picture of themselves so that we can deal with, you know, issues about authorship, because I'm a copyright nerd. But it looks like someone's already done that. So we've got an article here called How to Teach Your Dog to Take Selfies and Text Them to You. There's no treats involved, but, you know, I think the dog intended to take that picture. Call PETA. I still think, you know, there's some kind of, if I don't know, this is pretty darn close to it. The video that we're watching is sort of a very DIY video of someone taking a simple button, a simple webcam, and putting it on a wooden box hooked up to a Raspberry Pi, I think, or maybe some kind of Arduino, and just sending you a text message with the photograph from the webcam every time the dog or whatever animal presses the button. So getting ever closer to the original intent may be necessary to award copyright. We'll see.
Naruto Part 2.
I know. Naruto just continues to give us endless amounts of content. Thank you, Naruto. All right. So tip of the week, Franklin. You want to go ahead with this tip?
Yeah, definitely. So kind of shameless self-promotion here. I have a YouTube channel that I've started. I've had a YouTube channel for a while. I've never done anything with it, but I guess I was inspired by Denise and Evan back in the day, but finally got around to creating videos. And so the YouTube channel right now is kind of focused on law school strategy. And so that's essentially what I've done, is create videos on a weekly basis related to law school and guidance for law students. Friend of the show, Dennis Kennedy, was the most recent person I interviewed for this weekly series I'm doing called How I Graduated from Law School with a Job. So there's some more of my fancy fancy video work there, but so essentially it's a way for law students to feel encouraged and not feel alone or feel stressed out as much as possible during the job search process all throughout school. And so that's the main focus of it. But I've put a book together as well because I realized I hold a position with the ABA for law, like basically getting law students plugged into their IP section. That's also why I'm in town and in the studio is because of the ABA. I'm down in San Francisco at their annual conference. But so through my leadership involvement with them, I've gotten the chance to talk with dozens of law students. And I realized over time I was basically saying the same thing and giving them tips and tricks and strategy basically that I used. And I chose a really fancy title, How I Graduated, or How to Graduate Law School with a Job, just as a clickbait type situation. But I really do hope that it allows law students to feel like they're not alone and that the job search is definitely really difficult. But the book comes out later this month on August 22nd. But
awesome.
And then, of course, the videos are free. You can go watch those. And yeah, I'm just going to keep growing it. I started this back at the beginning of July, so it's a really young channel. I obviously don't have very many subscribers. I'm not doing it to make money. I'm just doing it for the fun of it. So,
good for
well, you.
You
might want a pro tip. Avoid standing in front of the green screen unless you want to see your face plastered on some, you know.
yeah.
Maybe photographs you wouldn't like.
Hey, all maybe right, that's so like, got... maybe I could do like a Barbara Streisand effect, and that would
absolutely
help people generate more views.
Unintentional. All right. Well, that is an excellent resource. I know that our listeners would value that. I want to cover two quick resources of the week before we wrap up the show. The first resource of the week is the Something Can Be Done article resource that Colette brought up earlier. Definitely check that out on withoutmyconsent.com. As Colette elaborated on earlier, it is a resource guide for advocates, for victims of online harassment, runs the gamut. So they're doing great work. Definitely go check them out. And then I also definitely want to mention that New Media Rights, the organization that I credit as sort of getting me out in the world, they are a nonprofit as part that is sort of part of the California Western School of Law. They offer reduced fee and pro bono support for artists, creators, startups, entrepreneurs. They really fill a unique, necessary role in the community, and they just came out with a book. The book is called Don't Panic, and I highly recommend you check it out if you are any of the above, a creator, entrepreneur, filmmaker, musician, author. Basically, the book in plain English outlines exactly what you need to know and how you can go about not getting sued with your project. You'll learn how to form your business, protect your intellectual property, understand E&O insurance, and avoid problems when launching an app or internet-based service. So I think that's a resource that a lot of our listeners will value, and they're a really, really great organization. I can't say enough about New Media Rights. Go help them out. All right. So we've got our MCLE passphrases in the can. I think that is about a wrap. It's been an incredible show. I want to thank everyone that's been listening live. If you weren't listening live, rather, you can catch us live each Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific on twit.tv. Anyways, Franklin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an excellent discussion. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Emery and Mike. The excellent job filling in for Denise. It was a great, great, great job. I appreciate being on the show, and I enjoy it.
Thank you. Mike, do you have anything to add before we wrap?
No, great to be back. Great to see you all. And Franklin, really appreciate you being with us today. That was terrific.
Yeah, Franklin, outside of your Lily's Grand Adventure, is there anything else you'd like to plug?
Basically the ABA, because that's the reason I'm here. I think the American Bar Association, if you're an attorney or a law student, there are amazing opportunities to get involved there. I know it's kind of controversial and not everybody agrees with some of the policy they do, but if you want to be an effective change within the legal profession, I encourage you to join the ABA and contribute your thoughts and ideas. So, yeah.
All right. Well, with that, I think it's been another excellent episode of This Week in Law. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you next week. Don't forget to tune in to twit.tv for all your favorite podcasts, netcasts you love from people you trust. You know the tagline. All right. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye, all.